You're listening to 830 AM KSDP in Sandpoint, Alaska, K201DA in King Cove, Alaska.
Welcome to Outdoor Sport. I'm your host, Paul Torda. On the top of Mount Gordon-Lyon, overlooking Anchorage and the Arctic Valley ski area, is a set of buildings holding an important piece of Alaska's history. Site Summit is one of three Nike Hercules missile sites in south-central Alaska. In 2009, the U.S. Army agreed to preserve and allow interpretation of the site as a testament to those who served there during the Cold War. Friends of Nike Summit have diligently been restoring the site and offering regular tours to the general public. Last fall, I went on a tour and interviewed the volunteers and veterans about their experiences, including stories of operating a live nuclear weapons site in the brutally windy and cold environment of the Chugach Mountains. Stay tuned for Outdoor Sport.
You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1.
The Trump administration's freeze on funds that support infrastructure, food supplies, renewable energy, and a host of other needed services across the state has created confusion and anxiety for community nonprofits and local governments. Will most funds be released in time for summer construction season, or will programs be cut entirely? We'll discuss what is clear, what isn't, and what it could mean for the state's economy and future on the next Alaska Insight.
Friday night at 7 on Alaska Public Media Television.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer and Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Tordup. This show is on the Nike Summit missile site at Arctic Valley and a tour I did the fall of 2024. We'll start with an introduction to Site Summit from veteran Greg Durter and volunteer Jim Reckert while on a bus ride from Arctic Valley ski area to Site Summit.
So the Friends of Nike Site Summit was started basically in 2007. The history of potential annihilation of the site goes back to the late 90s, but we started, Jim got me roped into it when he said he was starting a friends group and to try to preserve the Nike site. And since I was stationed up there, I went along with it, and here we are many years later, and a lot of headaches that, and a lot of triumphs that you'll hear about. So anyway, my history, I'm a veteran of Site Summit. I was stationed up there from May of 1974 through December of 1976, so 2.5 years. And that's 3 winters, basically, or 2.5 winters. And we saw things up here that nobody that lives in Anchorage can possibly imagine, the conditions. The winds, the blizzards, and all that kind of stuff that occur up here, just 4,000 feet elevation above town. Really amazing. I wore two hats. I would volunteer with the Anchorage Ski Club, and so I volunteer at Arctic Valley, and mostly in the winter, but sometimes in the summer, and then I wore the other hat for Nike Site Summit. So we've been doing tours since 2013.
Oh, gosh.
It's about 2013 we've been doing.
Before then.
Well, we did unofficial tours. Maybe earlier than that. So we've really taken pride in what we've been able to accomplish. This friends group started off kind of tenuously, and once we started realizing how much work needed to be done, Jim and I both were thinking, what in the heck did we get ourselves into? But it's really been productive. We were able to stabilize and restore five buildings, and then the military has agreed to do a bunch of restoration too. The whole site is not entirely restored, but it's the best preserved full context Nike site in the country. We got both the integrated fire control that we'll be going to first. That's at the very top of the mountains, almost 4,000 feet above sea level, and that's where all the main radars and the main computers, if you will, very slow vacuum tube operation. But those were up there. And then we'll be going down to the launch area secondly. So right now we're going on Army property right through this gate here. This is, the public is not supposed to be back in this area. If the security forces find people back here, they can get pretty ornery. I'm gonna turn things over to Jim and talk about the Cold War a little bit.
Thank you, Greg. Yes, my name again is Jim Rankerts. So there are several different stories we want to tell you about today or cover. There's the Cold War, then there's the Cold War in Alaska, and then there's a story of the Nike sites in the Anchorage area, and then specifically Nike Site Summit, which we're going to be seeing today. And then there's the story of Friends of Nike Site Summit. And Greg referenced this a little bit. It's the story how a bunch of determined citizens and Nike veterans and some non-profit groups and agencies came together to save this Nike Hercules missile site. This is, as Greg mentioned, the Nike site that has the overall best contextual history of any of the Nike sites in the country. There were 145 Nike sites around the country. This is the best preserved one. Okay, up on our right here, if you look close, you can see the outline of Anchorage's favorite icon, the Arctic Valley Star, or now I guess it's called the Alaska Star. Can you, up on the right on the hillside there. Does anyone know when that is lit? Day after Thanksgiving, we have a winner. Anyone know when it is turned off? Okay, somebody's been reading their history here. Yeah, when the last musher and the Iditarod crosses under the Burled Arch in Nome. It's also lit one other day. You know when that is? One other day. We're coming up on it, actually. It's this Thursday or Wednesday. They light it on September 11th.
This flat area we just had gone through, we called it in the day, we called it Infantry Flats because the Army the infantry would practice down on the flatlands here. They call it the Hammer Range, high altitude marksmanship range now, because they practice. Some guys will go up there on the rock up above and they'll shoot 1,000 yards. They practice sniper firing and things like that. They'll shoot across the road here. And sometimes if you're trying to come up Arctic Valley and you're stopped by the military on both sides of this area, that's the reason, is because there's firing going on, and they usually stop it for like 20-minute periods. They don't want anybody getting in harm's way. So we're going to be pulling up shortly here. We're not going to have much of an overview, but we talk about the three batteries around Anchorage and how the whole system was laid out.
So my history here goes back to I literally grew up at Arctic Valley skiing with my parents and my two older brothers. I was born in Anchorage, and the same year that Site Summit became operational. My family history at Arctic Valley goes back to 1946, when my parents courted on skis up there. We have some wonderful movies. We have some old movies and slides and photos of skiing in the 40s, 50s, and 60s at Arctic. And I grew up in the shadow of it, but I kind of knew what it was about, but really didn't know, you know, the details until I got involved in Site Summit and learned a bunch of stuff that really surprised me.
So if this would have been yesterday, we'd point out way off on the left at about 9 o'clock or so is Kincaid Park. Everyone knows about that. That's where A Battery or Site Point was located. And then down here in front of us is Eagle River Flats, and across Kinnick Arm from Eagle River Flats, actually you can almost make out Goose Bay, And Site Bay, Charlie Battery, was across there. So we had three missile sites around Anchorage. One site would, how the usual rotation went was one site would be hot, one site would be on standby, and one site would be on maintenance. And then they'd rotate the thing around. Back in the day, the Soviets were always testing our borders. It became old news after a while. They'd fly their bear bombers, and they'd be intercepted by the F-4 Phantoms back in the day from various air bases around Alaska. But the Nike Hercules missiles were the last defense. So if there was a war going on and they were to invade Alaska and they evaded the fighters, Nike missiles would be would be employed. These things were, for the most part, most of them were nuclear tipped. They had 15 to 25 kilotons capacity that could be changed by just adding a little insert plug. They only had a range of about 90 miles, maybe a little farther from up here because of our elevation. So down in the States, around Chicago, Milwaukee, San Francisco, anywhere they had these things, wherever they were launched, someone underneath was not going to have a good day. But that would prevent megaton bombs from being dropped on big cities. To have a kiloton bomb going off at 100,000 feet was much preferable. Fortunately, we didn't have to do that. Okay, you can.
So the key idea of Nike Site Summit, it was a Cold War anti-aircraft missile site, and it was active from 1959 to 1979. During the operational period, this road was graded and in winter plowed daily. Some soldiers drove to and from the site, while others actually lived in the barracks at the top of the mountain. But Greg, you lived at the top of the mountain. Yeah, Greg lived up there. So one of the things Friends of Nike Site Summit always mentions, that we recognize that Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson is the landowner here. The operational needs of our men and women in uniform, our military, take priority over our preservation and interpretation activities. But we've worked out a really good programmatic agreement arrangement with Jay Bear, which allows us to do these tours. But this site is used for active training. It very closely resembles the upper part here, the mountainous terrain of Afghanistan. So it is an active area. So off to the left here, if you look very closely, I don't know if you can see it or not, it might be in the clouds down there, but if you look, if it is clear enough, you can see Anchorage's award-winning landfill.
So right up here on the left, it drops off fairly steeply here, and this area right where this road kind of turns to the right just as slightly, I had two good friends went driving off in their Datsun at night, and there may or may not have been alcohol involved. But their vehicle rolled six times, with little orange dots, and rolled six times and came up against a rock down there. It's what kept them from going another 1,000 feet down the mountain. And so we named this area Beard's Bluff, because Marv Beard was the one that owned the vehicle. And so this area got named after his mishap. So these different areas where guys had gone off were named after the person. We had Jolly's Corner, Priest's Curve, Beard's Bluff. It's a number of others that I've forgotten about. This corner right here, there'd be a 12, 15 foot drift, it was called the cut drift corner, or the cut bank corner, or something like that. But you did not want to get something named after you on this mountain, because it didn't have good connotations.
So. The military development during and after World War II transformed Anchorage dramatically, and the Nike Site Summit was one piece of a large and complex system designed to protect North America from Soviet air attack. So, before World War II, Anchorage was a very quiet and kind of backwater place, but it was transformed almost completely through the development of Fort Richardson and Army Base and Elmendorf Air Base, which are now combined into Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson. They were the logistics and administrative headquarters for the Aleutians campaign and the Lend-Lease program with the USSR. So there was a massive influx of military population and construction. But after World War II ended, when the Soviets and the U.S. Were the victorious allies, but the U.S., USSR, and United States had opposing economic and political systems. So not long after the post-war, our rivalry became known as the Cold War, and that began in 1946. Later on, we're going to have a quiz to see if you know when the Cold War ended.
Okay, right up ahead, you can start seeing the infrastructure of the launch area. So you can see a guard shack right in front of us. That was post one for the MPs, which, by the way, was my MOS. I was an MP. Wait, but that's post two, sorry. Post one is going to be right up here. And then alongside the road, we're going to just stop briefly by post three here and see if anyone can figure out what this post is made out of. Anyone got an idea?
Railroad ties.
Railroad ties, yeah. So this post, this is built to withstand the winds. So if you look on the left, you'll see our other posts that are kind of plywood built and everything. Well, there was a similar post here on the road that was not anchored down. There was no concrete slab on it, so it would blow around in these high winds. And the guys, some of my MP buddies, they determined that the Army is U.S. government, and at that time the Alaska Railroad was owned by the last federally owned railroad. And they thought, well, that's government. So they decided that, hey, let's make a transfer of property. And they accomplished that at midnight one night, went down to the railroad yard and got a couple pickup loads of railroad ties and built this.
Okay. You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Torda. This show is on the Nugget Summit missile site at Arlet Valley in a tour I did the fall of 2024. We continued with the narrative from Jim Reckert and Craig Durcher on a bus ride from the ski area to the site.
So we're passing what we call Lower Site Summit, the launch area. We're going to be coming back to that. We're going to go up to what's known as Upper Site Summit, but officially the Integrated Fire Control Area. So, well, we're going to be heading into the clouds. But on a nice sunny day, you can see Upper Site Summit. You can see the radar towers, which we'll be coming up to. So we're driving up here, and right now we're still on Joint Base Selmendorf-Richardson, but we're going to be briefly passing out of J-Bear land and going back onto Chugach State Park land for a short period, then going back onto to J-Bear. At Chugach State Park is all the land to the east of us, and it has quite its story. It had its 50th anniversary just two or three years ago. There were a lot of visionary Alaskans in the late 60s and early 70s, Lowell Thomas, Sharon Sista, Helen Niedhauser, Tom Meacham, who helped create the park. And it also had a help from a friend of the Lowell Thomas family who quietly lobbied the legislature back in the late 60s. Apparently we even have a recording from the Thomas family of the work he did down there. And that old family friend was famous aviator Charles Lindbergh.
So one of the things that when we would change duties, we get on the International Harvester van in the morning. You see right here on the right where it just drops off and there's no railing or anything. There was areas like this where it'd be the whiteout condition would be so bad, wet snow blanketing everything. There was no relief. The driver would have to stop and let one of us off. We'd have to walk around and feel for where the edge was, and then he would cue on us. And we'd be walking along just like we were blindfolded. You couldn't see anything. Okay, this little cement building right in front of us is the sewage plant. So this big curve right here was called Shithouse Turn. And on the left here was a helicopter landing pad. So critical mission needs were met with helicopters because our three sites were so far apart. If there was something that needed to be done at all three sites, or even two of them, instead of spending hours traveling between sites, they would just get on a helicopter.
A few years ago, we actually had one of the helicopter pilots turn up on one of our tours. and it was a real privilege to have a Nike veteran who is a helicopter pilot. But he said this site was his least favorite. This is back in the 60s. He said the helicopters we had were not that powerful, and that particular landing site was subject to a lot of swirling winds, and is that it was not their favorite place. Now the newer helicopters are much more powerful. So you guys are really lucky today, really, really lucky with this weather, because you'll get to experience what it was like for the soldiers here.
Just a little bit about, so this is the top of the site was the integrated fire control, and you'll see some models here. In fact, that model right back there will show that there was a two-story, multiple-use building. The barracks were up on top, and then all the infrastructure was down below. There was, we had to be like a battalion plus. We had to be able to survive on our own for 30 days, completely cut off. We had generators. You'll see down the stairs and to the right, there's two huge generators back in there. You'd see the boilers that kept everything warm. But that building was all made out of wood and clapboard and stuff. We couldn't save it. There was standing water at both levels, asbestos and lead-laden stuff falling off the walls. It had to be taken out. But J-Bear preserved, so you can see on this model out and outside, if you stick your head out there, you'll be able to see three of the radar domes that were left. So and they have been maintaining those things, keeping them painted and such. So when you're done in here, if you want to bravely walk out and look at where the footprint of the barracks was there, we had we had an armory. We had to be like a mini battalion. We had our own armory, we had our own mess hall, we had our own motor pool, and the cadre's quarters were on the first floor, offices and such. We had a recreation room, a dark room. I learned how to do some photography stuff in there. So we were pretty self-contained, had to be. Yeah, that was just the way it was. But about, you talk to different people, probably had 150, maybe more, totally associated with the missile site, but at any given time, there was people off and people doing other things, so never had that many people up here, except maybe a Christmas party or something like that.
What, let me ask you guys, so the Friends of, when was it formed? How long have you been working on this?
The Friends of Nike Site Summit was formed in 2007, and we've been working on it ever since then. Yeah. So a group of, citizens, Nike veterans. We had support from Judy Bittner with the State Office of History and Archaeology, which is part of the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation. Judy is our State Historic Preservation Officer. We also had a lot of help from the National Park Service, Ted Birkendall, Daryl Lewis, and then we partnered with the Alaska Association for Historic Preservation, which is now Preservation Alaska. They were the 501c3 nonprofit that we were able to work with. We're now in the process of forming our own nonprofit. And it was really a collaborative effort to get all these different groups together. We always are looking for new volunteers. We've had some more recent military veterans join as part of the operation. We've had the Alaska Military Youth Academy up here in the past helping out. It's really been a real success story what we've done.
It's an amazing amount of work you've done on this building.
They gave us five buildings. They said, if you can preserve these, do the hazardous materials abatement and reconstruct them, we'll keep them. But you've got 3 years to do it. And we said, sure, we'll do that. And then we came up here and started the process and went, oh my gosh, what have we gotten ourselves into? But we had a lot of work parties on Saturdays. We raised, got grants from the Atwood Foundation, the Rasmussen Foundation, the state legislature, and we started doing tours because we knew we needed to bring people up here to show how cool this place was and to get more people involved. And overall, it's worked. There's still work to do. We're still always looking for new people to get involved. There's more renovation, preservation work we want to do, but we've done the hard part.
that we're listening to Outdoor Explorer in Alaska Public Media, and I guess my tour guide here is telling me we got to go to our next stop. Thanks.
So we were talking earlier about animals. So, yeah, we're coming up to the dog kennels, but as far as wild animals, one time we came up here in a work party, and we got out to the front gate, there was a moose just standing right there, kind of keeping us from opening the gate. He was taking his own sweet time about moving on, but eventually he did. But one other time, we planned a work party, and Jay Bear said, yeah, that'll be fine. They're going to be doing some firing at the range that Saturday, but get up there before that and then shut the gate behind you, and then you cannot leave until you check in with us. And we're like, okay. So we did that, we're working away, and they start firing. We hear this boom, boom, boom off in the distance. And then we see this black bear just come running up over the hill on the outside of the fence. This poor little black bear, and, you know, he was down there in the firing, and he's like, okay, I'm beating feet out of here. Fortunately, he was on the other side of the fence from us.
We have our dog handler, Tom Nombet, giving the talk because he was stationed up here for part of his tour. He was down at A Battery, Sight Point, for most of his Alaska tour, but he did spend about 8 months up here over the winter, and he likes to talk about working the dogs by night and skiing by day. he was basically a one-man dog show back to, actually there's probably two dogs, but they were pretty busy, but he didn't mind. He was left alone. He was here when the cadre were not, and he just did his thing here and skied, and I did too. So for him, the season pass down at Arctic Valley in 1968 was $10. My season pass by 1970, mid-70s, 74, 75, time frame was, I think it was $26, so I made a little more. I think I was up to a couple hundred dollars a month for my pay. But the dogs worked, one dog, one handler. You didn't handle anybody else's dog except to give them water and clean their cages. They had to go to Lackland Air Force Base and learn and train with their dog, so they took their dog with them wherever they went. When they moved on, they got out of the Army or transferred some to a different MOS or something, someone else would have to go and retrain on their dog, and then that dog became that person's specific canine. The dogs, you can see how big the cages were. The dogs had their food, their water was kept warm with these electric heaters. And the food was dry, and the place is not heated. Otherwise, they wanted the dogs to maintain their fur in the wintertime. So their kennels in back, you can go around back later on and take a look at them. The kennels had straw in them. The command for so each dog handler didn't have to take care of his own dog. You could take care of other dogs, but there was a command. They said, go in your house. And the dogs were trained to respond to that command, and they would all go back in their house, and then there's a little pulley and chain system, and you could let the door down on all the kennels that had dogs in them, and then you could clean out the poop and change the water and all that kind of stuff. This trough here was a sewage trough for the waste, and there's a little metal pipe standing in the tundra out there. Beneath that was the doggy septic system, so we treat the water a little bit before it dumped down into the drinking water. By the way, someone asked about some of the switchbacks and stuff, the traces up on the side of the hill. The water for Site Summit came down from that little check dam that's down at the ski area, you know, that little dam before you go to the lodge. Mm-hmm. That water was pumped here and then to the top for our drinking water. And it was, back in the day, we didn't, I mean, I'm sure they treated a little bit, but we didn't have nearly the traffic. There was hardly any dogs or anything running around the countryside here, so the water would have been a lot cleaner.
You are listening to the Outdoor Explorer and our show on the Nike Missile Site Summit at Arctic Valley. We'll be back with more of our tour after a short break.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1, connecting Alaskans, life informed.
Alaska Public Media is all about community. Wear your community on your sleeve with the purchase of branded clothes and collectibles from our online store. Visit alaskapublic.org/shop.
Support for Alaska Public Media comes from members like you and from
Alaska Air Transit, flying Alaskan families, essential workforce, and cargo to communities statewide, specializing in on-demand charters. There's more at flyaat.com.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordap. We'll continue with our tour of the historical Nike Missile Site Summit at Arlet Valley with more stories of the dog kennels, working their winter, the Arlet Valley Star, and more from Greg Dorcher and Jim Rankert.
Tom had an interesting story to tell about when he was at A-Battery, and A-Battery's commanding officer decided he was going to have Tom put his dogs through the paces. He wanted. Out back here, you'll see three yellow barrels that are sitting up there. Well, these would be quite a bit of stuff. They're culverts and beans and things for the dogs to work on. And so the commander down there wanted to see him put his dog through the paces. And so they came in the building, and the dogs, there's three or four of them, the dogs that saw this strange face come in the room, they went nuts. They were spinning around in their kennels, and dog poop was flying everywhere, and he was jumping back, and Tom said, go to your house. And all of them stopped, all of them went in the house, and he was so impressed, he said, I've seen enough. And he turned around and left. So Tom said, well, that was a good thing. He was all prepared to run them through their paces and everything. But Tom did have a story about one time his dog keyed on something down there, and there was a lot of tall grass. It wasn't tundra like it is here. And he couldn't see what was going on, so he let his dog loose to go attack whatever, and the dog got into a porcupine. Oh. And took it to the vet, but one of the quills could be extracted, and so he was on an extended period without his dog, and the quill finally worked its way all the way through and out the shoulder and the back, which is what porcupine quills do, and then he was able to get his dog back again. We had to, once in a while, the dog handlers would have to train the dogs, and one of us would put on this big burlap suit, and we'd be on the east end of the kennel, and the dog handler would be on this end of the kennel, and you'd be in your burlap suit, and he'd let the dog loose at you and say attack or something, I don't know. But those shepherds, when they hit you, even though you had a lot of straw and everything, they hit hard. It was like being run into by a linebacker, and you'd stick your arm out for them to grab your arm. I remember there was one dog that I think it was Tiny Anderson's dog. He wouldn't go for the arm, he'd go for the crotch. And that was, and so you'd be getting your arm down there, but that wasn't the thing that he was going for. That dog was too smart for his own good. So I'm going to let you go. There's a picture of Tom in the back with his dog Shadow, and you can see the kennels, actual dog houses, and then I may or may not be able to answer questions. So I wasn't a dog handler, but let's go on and go around back here.
So, what was the worst weather you had up here? Can you describe? Remember, like an incident that was still like, oh, we might be in trouble.
Every winter we had an anemometer on this building, and every winter that I was up here, and probably every winter always, the anemometer would disintegrate at 120, 120 knots.
Wow.
125 knots.
What knots? So that's like 130.
Yeah, about 130 miles an hour, we'd lose our anemometer.
Wow. And but you didn't go outside.
We had to go. We had to do our thing. No, we didn't. We weren't as animated in our activities.
And what about wildlife? Any outstanding wildlife encounters do you guys have up here?
We didn't have. I've seen more bear now than I did back in the day. Moose weren't too prevalent either now or then. But what we did have then, but that we don't have now, is doll sheep on Gordon Lion. There'd be doll sheep up there, but there's so many people with their dogs and kids and everything that the sheep have abandoned the area.
I always have a question. Did you ever see a caribou up here? I always heard rumors of caribou in the Two Hats, but
I've seen coyotes, but I haven't seen caribou.
Okay. Interesting. And you were up here 3 years?
Two and a half years.
You said you were an MP, is that right?
Yeah, 95 Bravo.
Great. And then you're also involved in this here also. So you spent a lot of time up here.
Yeah, 50 years.
50 years. Well, excellent. We're really enjoying the tour.
Yeah.
Up, you can see this little square box-looking thing there right in front, straight in front of the bus there. That's actually a sewer casement. We got a bunch of these things from the municipality, and actually could have been the Anchorage Borough back in the day. And they put these things out for us to use as pillboxes to defend the site. There's a lot of Mideast conflicts and stuff going on. They were kind of concerned. And we went out and looked at these supposed gun positions that they put out here. And we looked at each other and said, we're not going to die in a sewer. So there were plenty of rocks to hide behind, in our opinion. So I was asked about wildlife. Back in the day, we didn't have, I don't remember ever seeing a bear up around the launch area or around up here. I could have just been lucky. But Gordon Lion, which is a high peak that you can't see about a mile from here, that was a popular hiking spot for us. And we'd see doll sheep that you don't see anymore. The people and their dogs and everything, this was not a big hiking mecca or berry picking mecca like it is now. And so the sheep were still around, but they've since retreated to the backcountry. You'll notice that a lot of these railings alongside the road are railroad track, old railroad track, and that was legally obtained.
They put the rail into guardrail.
Kincaid embodies the proverb, we shall turn swords into plowshares. We took a Nike Hercules missile site and we turned it into Anchorage is flagship park, where we turned missiles into mountain bikes, skis, and soccer balls. Very, very cool.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Tordat. We are on a tour of the Nike Summit missile site at Ardent Valley. Close with a bus ride back to the ski area, yes, and more on the Ardent Valley Star.
So on the left, we'll be coming up to where there's a gate. Right here where the wire going down, that wire goes down to where the star is. And then there's a gate right up here in front of the bus. The engineers, every fall, they come down and they maintain the star. So they would have done that already, got all the light bulbs, make sure they're working. It's LED now. It's about 350 feet across. It started out as a little project from a officer that wanted to see a star up here when the Nike site was built. And there was a 15-foot star built back in the day. All you could see was a pinprick of light on the mountain, so they expanded it over the years. So this sentry station, this is the color it was when I was stationed here in 1976. I had taken pictures of different things, even though I wasn't supposed to, I imagine. but they used one of my photos to match the color. So this whole area is restored to what it looked like in 1976. So there's always somebody in this guard post, usually a couple people, sergeant of the guard being one of them, and then one, two, three other guys would come wandering in as we were
doing roving patrols and this and that. So if you're that little side window that I opened up, that surrounded by that black wood there, that's where you turn in your limited area badge, and then we find the guy's picture. So only people that were authorized to go in exclusionary had badges, and then you'd put their limited area badge on the hook, get their exclusionary badge, and so we all knew who was in there at all times. A couple times a day, if the site was on standby or maintenance, there wouldn't always people. There wouldn't always be what we call pit rats, the 16 Bravos, the missile people back here, and so we would have to check all the doors. And that box you can see, or that in the back, there's all kinds of little gaping holes in that panel. That used to have buzzers, and we'd test the doors. Two people would have to sign out the keys. Sergeant of the Guard and one of the rest of us would sign out these keys. You'd open the door, pretty massive door in the back of these bunkers. You open the door and the alarm would go off, and then they'd say on the radio, you know, you're clear and all that sort of thing. And we'd go in and we'd check the missiles and all that. I did not ever count how many missiles we had in there. You'd see all these went lined up, and I figured, well, if the Ruskies ever catch me and torture me, I wouldn't be able to tell them how many missiles we had in each bunker. It was that kind of logic, you know, they ingrained into us. One of the Sergeant of the Guard, he wanted to do a door check, and there was one big thunderstorm cell sitting above us, a big cumulonimbus cloud that looked like it was ready to produce lightning. Usually it was like one lightning bolt and that was the end of the storm. But he wanted to go out during that storm, and I protested. We went out there and my hair stood up on end, and a lightning bolt went streaking right over us. And I said some things to him that you normally couldn't get away with, but he was scared enough that I did get away with it. Got a lot of stories from this site. You know, I spent a lot of time up here. We actually, on the infantry flats down below, we could actually look down the fence here, and in the wintertime, when it was really blowing up here, it would just be gently snowing down there, but it would be screaming up here, and the snow would drift over the roads, making them impassable. So a bulldozer or a rotary plow would come down from the top. We'd watch it come down the mountain, carving its path down the road, go around the corner, and then we'd look over the fence every once in a while, and we'd see it would catch up to where there'd be, we'd have a light turned red, so there was a post with a red and green light on it. We'd have the light turned red, the car's all queued up behind it, the blower would turn around, there's a place where he could turn around, and then go back, leading this retinue of vehicles. We'd turn the light green for like 15 minutes so anyone could catch up. They'd work their way around that corner, and just below that far corner on the left there, that's where the wind started, and he would have to now the road is completely redrifted over again. He'd have to plow his way back up the mountain with the cars trailing behind, and after about 15 minutes we'd flip the light to red, which would line up the next group of cars. That's gives you some idea. The other thing we did was we turned on the star. That wasn't automated like it is now. And if you forgot, there's always somebody in Anchorage that would call try to call the base commander and the post commander and say, hey, they didn't turn the star on. One time I had a friend that lived in Government Hill, so above the port, and I said, can you see the star on the mountain? And he had a long cord on his telephone. He pulled over and said, yeah. I said, watch this. I blinked the star. He thought that was pretty cool, and I didn't get caught for that one, but I a lot of us would get in our various Beetle Bailey kind of incidents, and one of the things that I did get caught on was I was roving back and forth on a berm, and it's straight behind the bus. Can't see it. You'll see it in a while, but straight behind the bus, back and forth about 150 yards for 4 hours at a time. And so I started playing quick draw with my 45, and I got really good. I'd sit there, so I'd hold a rock up just about head level, in a drop-in. By the time it got to my waist, I could have my 45 drawn, and then I could twirl it back, forth, whatever, drop it back in the holster, you know, and think I'm kind of Wyatt Earp, you know. And one time there was a colonel in a guard shack here that I didn't know about, and one of my buddies was in there, the colonel and the sergeant of the guard, and colonel looked up and said, what's that soldier doing up there? And the old Louisiana boy said, well, sir, looks like he's playing quick draw. And they told me, well, you want to tell him to stop doing that? So I got the radio call. I didn't think it was a big deal, but I got extra duty for doing that. And extra duty was typically they give you a can of paint and a paintbrush. So I painted something, I don't know what. But that fast forward 50 years or something like that, actually about 40 some years at that time, Friends of Nike say someone is abating the paint on this shack here, and someone scraped off a right angle corner that stood up by itself of paint on the molding, and our historical architect looked at it through a binocular microscope and counted 27 layers of paint on this 20-year-old building. So there's a lot of extra duty. But the worst thing I did, what's the worst thing? Who's your favorite child? One of the worst things I did was one night I was wandering around the outer loop here, and Gary Dobbins and Jim Maranta, the sergeant of the guard, were in there playing spades, which is our favorite game to play up here. And there was a sandbag position out by the fence here. And I saw those guys in the nice warm guard shack, windows, you know, the lights are merrily glowing, and I'm out here cold, windy, and I thought, well, I'll just tease them a little bit. And I picked up a rock. Now, the windows were all plexiglass, so I wasn't worried about it. I picked up a rock, threw it at the shack just a little bit, and it ticked the shack, and they looked up, and then they went back to playing cards. So I took another rock, and I threw it harder, and hit the side of the building, just whack. And I hit down behind the sandbags, you know, I didn't think this thing out very well. And the door burst open and I heard shh, shh, shh. So you don't want to hear that sound when that sound is all about you. And Gary came running out to the fence here and he's looking down, and it's dark, you know, looking down, and I jumped up and said, it's me, Greg. And he swung that M16 around waist level, and I just about peed myself. But I got extra duty for that. Imagine that. The one thing that we did one time that we didn't get extra duty for is that, not the last commander, but like the second or third to the last commander up here, wanted us all to pick all the rocks, this whole area here, between here and that fence, the limited area fence, he wanted all the rocks over 6 inches in diameter picked up. Wow. It was like, what, we're on a mountain, what are you talking about? But you know, you say, yes sir, how high and what color? So brought a big old deuce and a half, and the back end of one of those things is like about 6 feet off the ground, and we were hurling rocks up into that, and we brought it down to a low spot down along the outside fence, and one of the things we grabbed was this big pipe with a big ball of concrete on the end of it that was bigger than 6 inches, so we figured that has to go. We were throwing all the rocks out, and a couple of us to throw this pipe over the fence, and it went down the hill, and we were fascinated by how it was whacking the tundra, and it was kicking up sod and everything, and whacking down, going faster and faster, and it disappeared over this lip. And we watched for a few seconds, and all of a sudden we saw light bulbs and wire and stakes flying up in the air. The way they were moving away from us was just like slow motion. It went right through one of the arms of the star. Aww. And we laughed so hard we couldn't even stand up. We were laying on the back of the truck, kicking our legs on the yeah, you know, you're young and entertained easily. But we didn't get extra duty for that one because we did exactly what we were told to do. But that was the end of our rock picking exercises. So we were done with that.
Okay, we'll start heading down.
And now you can actually see Anchorage a little bit there. You can see Fort Richardson, you can see Elmendorf, you can see Anchorage. And way out there, the airport, Ted Stevens International Airport, to the left of that, is Battery 8, Kincaid Park. So we've had a lot of work parties up here over the years. We are still have them, but in the those first few years when we were working to try to save all the sites, there was a period in September, that might have been the first
straight. Okay, I'm sorry. I thought you were going back down to the launch control building.
It was been real foggy in Anchorage for several days, and the day we, the Saturday we came up here to do the work party, and it was foggy in Anchorage. It was foggy. But as we drove up here, we broke above the clouds, and it was sunny and it was warm, and we could look down, and it was just foggy throughout South Central Alaska. We all looked at each other and said, you know, I don't think there's a better place to be in South Central Alaska right now than right here. It was really, really nice.
There were many times when I'd be walking the perimeter and the clouds would fill the valley, and it looked just like, I imagine what it looked like in the ice ages with the ice filling the valley, and the mountains poking up like nunataks in a ice field. One time was really weird. I was standing on the fence above the star, kind of looking down at Infantry Flats, and the clouds were coming up. They had been rising for quite a while, and all of a sudden they spilled over the top, and they were going right between my legs, right around my feet. That was the top level of the clouds. I'm here to tell you cannot walk on the top of a cloud, though. That area right in front of us there, that big flat area, that's now where they do sniper exercises and stuff, training for the Hammer Range. But that was, we finally figured out there's all kinds of concrete foundation stuff there, and none of us, we used to call that gun site, because we thought that there was some kind of World War II gun positions there, but the fact was that's where they had the concrete manufacturing plant. They used to make the concrete to pour up at the top, so they didn't have to bring truckfuls of concrete up the mountain. Yeah. Right now you can see Eagle River Flats right square in front of us, down on this side of Kinnick Arm, and then on the other side the Goose Bay Flats looks very similar to the Eagle River Flats on this side, and Charlie Battery is just like a thumb length to the right of Goose Bay.
So, as we mentioned earlier, the development of intercontinental ballistic missiles as the primary warhead delivery system in the mid-60s rendered Nike an anti-aircraft system obsolete, and the 145 sites around the country, most of them were shut down in conjunction with the strategic arms limitation talks that began in 1971, the SALT talks. SF-88 in the Marin Highlands near San Francisco, it was agreed in the SALT talks to preserve it as a museum for the treaty. It's now managed by the National Park Service as part of Golden Gate National Rec Area. The Anchorage Defense Area and Homestead Defense Area near Miami were kept intact for longer. Homestead is inside Everglades National Park and is also open for tour. So Alaska has continued to serve as an early warning role in the Cold War, and now it's been replaced by things like the ballistic missile early warning system at Clear Air Force Base, later the Cobra Dane radar system at Erickson Air Force Station out at Shemya Island in the Aleutians. But no technology for actually stopping an inbound missile was feasible until the early 2000s. Ground-based mid-course defense missiles were established at Fort Greely, and Alaska Army and Air National Guards currently conduct missile defense operations against our current main missile threat of North Korea. And so it was over. On your left, as you look up on the hillside, you can see the Arctic Valley Star.
Interesting story on the star that we just recently
her one of the nurses on flights returning from Vietnam with injured on board, as the plane was coming to Anchorage for a refueling stop, it would she would tell the patient, she said, "When you see the star in the distance out the window, you'll know you're home." That was kind of touching. And you'll note that we're always looking for volunteers and donations, especially at this point, volunteers. You know, I'm closer to the finish line than I am from the start, as are a lot of us. So anyway, we need a new generation to start taking over some of this stuff. And we're also, of course, interested in donations. Now, we are currently under the umbrella, the nonprofit umbrella of Preservation Alaska, and they don't really want to be in the missile business, so they've asked that we form our own 501c3, which we're in the process of doing. We've completed just about all the hurdles. Now we just need we need to get approval from the IRS to become our own 501c3, at which point tax deductible donations can be made straight to us. If you want to make a donation now, you make it to Preservation Alaska, and then make sure on the memo line and in a cover letter say that it's for Friends of Nike Site Summit.
So the Cold War ended peacefully, thanks to 40 years of effort and vigilance by our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines all over the world. And do we have any Cold War or other veterans here today? Okay, we got Greg. Anybody else?
We got active military.
We have active military here. We have active military here with Melissa up front. So thank you all very much. So we'd like to think of, especially with the star, as when you're back down in town and you're showing visitors or talking to your kids or grandkids about Anchorage, and you look up at the star, remind them that that is not just a symbol of victory and a symbol of peace, but it's also a symbol of hope. There was a peaceful end to the worldwide conflict.
Next week, we have a Alaska Nike Hercules Veterans Reunion coming up. So we've talked to Margaret, and she's passed it along. They might light up the star during our reunion, so possibly Monday through Thursday night. But that's not 100% guaranteed right now. But if you do see the star on after 9/11, it's because the Nike veterans are meeting in town here.
Wouldn't that be cool?
That would be very cool.
Thanks to Friends of Nike Site Summit and the volunteers and veterans that helped make this show happen. Special thanks to our interpreters Greg DeRocher and Jim Reichert and Morgan Grover with JBear. Also thanks to our producer Tobin Shelby with additional help from Ammon Swenson. I'm your host Paul Twardock of Outdoor Explorer, and we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.
Aleutian Peninsula Broadcasting is generously supported by the City of Sandpoint. Sandpoint is a first-class city in the Aleutians East Borough, located on Humboldt Harbor on the northwestern Popoff Island. Anchorage is 575 nautical miles to the northeast. The Sandpoint City Council meets the second Tuesday of every month at 7 p.m. in the City Hall Council Chambers. Contact the City of Sandpoint by calling 907-383-2696, emailing sptcity@arctic.org. sandpointak.net or visiting their website at sandpointak.com. KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint. K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove. KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay. KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass.